This is The Takeaway with MHP. From WNYC and PRX in collaboration with GBH News in Boston.
It's been more than a year since the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. He was killed in his home, where he was with his wife and their two children. And records show that he made several phone calls to top security officials while a squad of former Colombian soldiers ran through his home, firing guns. Outside, neighbors heard two men with American accents through a megaphone saying, quote, "This is Operation DEA." And at 1:46 a.m., Moïse made one last call, asking to save his life. Then the call dropped. He was held at gunpoint and shot at point-blank range. Only 5 weeks later, a 7.2 magnitude earthquake killed more than 2,000 people. And gangs have divided the capital of Port-au-Prince, displacing as many as 100,000 Haitians. Amid the violence and political chaos, there's a deadly cholera outbreak and a worsening famine. Joining me now is Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Can you remind us a bit about what led up to the assassination of President Moïse?
Well, I think that a lot of people forget that prior to the assassination, which occurred on the 7th of July, 2021, President Moïse was having a very difficult time. He was a controversial president. There was a debate about whether or not his mandate had ended on the 7th of February or not, and that all was tied to his election, where allegations of fraud and findings basically postpone the vote. It had to be retaken, and then he didn't get into office until 2017. So it all came down to sort of a math question and the Haitian constitution. But also, President Moïse at some point dismissed parliament. There was a tweet that went out that basically said parliament is no longer functional, and he was ruling by decree, one-man rule. And so we were writing stories about, you know, the criticism that he was trying to become Latin America and the Caribbean's next dictator. He was passing various laws by executive order. He tried to create some sort of a secret intelligence agency that finally got some criticism from the international community, especially the United States, which really had sort of been supporting him for all intents and purposes. And so all of a sudden, you know, you get a phone call and it says the president has been killed. And you're like, what? It's not that we were not looking at him and saying, okay, this is a guy that's accumulated a lot of enemies all across the board. How far is this going to go? But definitely, when it happened, everyone was surprised. And it was shocking. I mean, it had been more than a century since the last time a Haitian president had been assassinated.
And that instability has really continued to matter, right, since his assassination, in part because it meant there was no ability to confer legitimacy on the next leadership?
You know, it's much more complicated than that, because what you have is a country with no institutions. You have a parliament where you only had 10 people left that were in a Senate that normally supposed to have 30 elected officials. Those 10 individuals weren't even enough to have a quorum. You had a constitution that was in disarray. You had a country that was out of its constitution, and so it couldn't even follow the constitution in terms of the line of succession. Implicated in his murder, you know, it was a Supreme Court justice whom he had illegally fired months before. And of course, you had this gang problem that people are hearing about today, the gang violence, the kidnappings. It didn't happen because the president was assassinated. It just got worse because the president was assassinated. And what you see is, yes, psychologically, mentally, the emphasis that people put on having a quote unquote president, somebody who's elected, and how that sort of relays a sense of rule of law, even if there is no rule of law. Because the way Haiti is structured really is the prime minister that runs the day-to-day operations of the country. But today there is no president. And yes, there's a prime minister that he named prior to his assassination, but that prime minister was never approved by a parliament. So things are not happening the way they're supposed to. And so now what you have is a country that's just in disorder and chaos. And the gangs are becoming more and more influential. We saw this fuel blockade in September. It went on for 2 months. People couldn't get food, fuel, medicine. Today, you know, you walk out of your house, you don't know if you're going to make it back in. Millions of children have not been able to go to school. No, it's a situation where it's just insecurity and violence and kidnappings. And yet people are like, what do we do next? Yes, there is a police force, but it's 12,000 police officers for a country with 12 million people.
Lay on top of that, cholera.
Yes. So cholera was last in Haiti just shortly after the 2010 earthquake. That was a very devastating earthquake, according to the Haitian government. 316,000 people died. 10 months after that earthquake, we get confirmation of cholera. I was in Haiti all of that time. We were waiting for something to happen. Everybody was concerned that there would be some disease to happen. And then, boom, it's cholera. And I remember even the Pan American Health Organization, which is the regional body for the World Health Organization, they were like, no, it can't be cholera. Too many people are dying. This can't be cholera. It has to be something else. And it turned out that it was cholera, right? Because the waterway had basically gotten infected with this bacteria. So fast forward this year, and what happened? So in July, we see more gang violence erupt in the country's largest slum, Cité Soleil. Over 400 people are killed or injured. Women are being raped. Nothing is getting out. Nothing is getting in. And that means water. That means water trucks. But Haiti hasn't had a confirmed case of cholera in almost 3 years. And so, you know, this country was really thinking that it was on its way to getting rid of cholera. And then we get confirmation of cholera. And when does this confirmation come? It comes during this fuel blockade. The distribution companies that distribute water are saying, we have to temporarily halt distribution because we don't have fuel to treat the water. And then we realized that in this area where you had this massacre and this gang rampage, that people were basically left to drink infected water. And a lot of the victims are children, you know. And so today you have a cholera outbreak that is in 8 of the 10 regional departments of the country. So basically it's everywhere.
We need to take a quick pause. We're going to be right back with more on Haiti. This is The Takeaway.
Carnegie Hall has welcomed a dizzying array of performers.
To have Andy Kaufman, Frank Zappa, and Birgit Nielsen and Horowitz on the same stage, it becomes this kaleidoscope of our history.
I'm Jessica Vosk. Join me for the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk. It's all about our unique cultural history, as witnessed by one of New York's most beloved institutions, Carnegie Hall. Listen now, wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for sticking with us on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're back and continuing our conversation with Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, you were walking us through the cholera crisis and the ways that it has now intersected with these pre-existing crises to create a life-threatening circumstance. And you were saying, especially for children.
Exactly, especially for children, because they are the victims. We are seeing reports in terms of, very worrying reports, in terms of the number of children who are either suspected of having cholera or who have confirmed to have cholera. And even though we just had some cholera vaccines that arrived in Haiti this week, the question always gets to, how do you get it to the people who need it? The gangs are still there. They're still controlling the corridors, the roads. They're still in these communities. And so access, especially for aid workers and even police, is very difficult. And so that's the biggest challenge is facing the humanitarian community that wants to help. But how do you even get something as basic as fresh water, potable water, to the communities that right now are dealing with a cholera outbreak?
This question of outside assistance is also at the core here. Walk us through the government having requested external international assistance and the ways that the people have maybe not asked for this kind of external so-called assistance.
So I'll take you back to September when we saw the gang blockade of the country's main fuel terminal, which accounts for 80% of the fuel. And so you had a situation where the police cannot penetrate. The gang is not just controlling the fuel terminal access, but even the roads. And so there was this talk about this humanitarian corridor. And especially when they confirmed cholera, it was like everybody went into a panic because we've been here before. We know how this thing can spread very quickly. You know, there were at least 10,000 dead the last go round and over 800,000 people who were infected with it. And so, you know, the Haitian government asked for some sort of foreign assistance. They left it sort of open-ended, but we needed a rapid force deployed to come and to assist the Haitian National Police. They were very careful. They didn't say that they wanted a United Nations peacekeeping mission because that's always been controversial in Haiti. But they made this request, and the request was supported by the UN Secretary General, which is Antonio Guterres, and the United States. The United States with Mexico actually wrote a resolution basically asking for countries to step up at the Security Council and to basically field some sort of a force that will go into Haiti and create a humanitarian corridor that would, for instance, allow you to get cholera vaccines or potable water to communities that are in need, along with the Haitian National Police. Well, what we've seen is that there has been no takers. I think that this request has been caught up, one, in geopolitics, in the sense that today you have Russia and China. They are members of the Security Council. They do not favor Haiti returning under Chapter 7, which is essentially Security Council supervision. And some have said, well, then we have to flip the bill for it. But, you know, one can also argue that this is a result, too, of, you know, their relations with the United States, because they see that the U.S. is pushing this. But also in Haiti, this is a very touchy topic. If you say to Haitians, are you in favor of a foreign occupation, a U.S. Mm-hmm. occupation? They're going to tell you, no, this country went through one in 1915. But if you say to Haitians, are you in favor of assistance to your police, your security assistance, you get a different response. And I have to tell you that I get so many messages from people in Haiti from all walks of life. Where are the troops? When are they coming? People just can't anymore. Children cannot go to school. Professionals cannot go to work. People's businesses are literally dying. Those who can have left the country and they're in the United States, you know, maybe for a couple of weeks at a time. Some have gone to the DR, but we're seeing boats, loads of Haitian refugees, you know, risking their lives at sea, trying to get to the U.S. vis-a-vis Florida Keys or Puerto Rico. So when you talk to those people, you know, they tell you something different, because today you are in your house and you are being held hostage. You are a prisoner. You don't know if the next knock on your door is going to be a troop of armed individuals that are coming into your house. It's no longer, you know, the kidnappings only happen here or this community is flooded by gangs. Everybody's telling me the gangs are everywhere now. Mm-hmm. Increasingly, there's no more safe space, especially in the capital. And we're seeing massacres happening in rural communities outside of Port-au-Prince.
Jacqueline Charles is the Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining us today, even with this very, very hard news.
Thank you for having me.